This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli. Red Sox fans are debating the pros and cons of a future baseball stadium which will replace Boston's Fenway Park, one of the oldest playing fields in the country. Constructed in 1912, Fenway has inspired and exasperated players and fans alike. With its idiosyncratic field, hard bench seats, manual scoreboard, and decaying locker rooms. Dan Shaughnessy was one of those kids who fell in love with baseball after watching his first game with his dad at Fenway Park. Shaughnessy is a sports writer with the Boston Globe and is the author of Fenway, a biography in words and pictures. There are no seats in Fenway's outfield to serve as a target for home run hitters. Instead, there's a huge wall in the outfield known as the Green Monster. If a ball hits the wall, it's still in play. So line drives which would have made it into the stands as home runs in other parks become singles or doubles at Fenway. And the flip side is, pop-ups which normally would be caught in a larger field become easy homers. Fresh Air's Marty Moscowane asked Shaughnessy to describe the Green Monster.
Well, it really is the signature aspect of Fenway Park. It's this enormous, the wall is 37 feet high. The breadth of it is quite a lot more than that, well over 100 feet. And when you walk into the park, you're struck by it. It's very green, and it appears very close because of the size of it. This is a function of the streets of Boston. When the ballpark was laid out in 1912, there's certain things you don't want. You don't want the sun setting in the hitter's eyes, and there's certain ways you need to lay out a ballpark so that, particularly during day baseball, which is all they had in 1912. And because of this, it had to be angled a certain way, and because it's crammed into a neighborhood in Boston, really shoehorned in there, there's streets all around it, and the street right beyond left field was bordered by railroad tracks. It's the Framingham commuter rail now, and the Massachusetts Turnpike is also now alongside that commuter rail. So they were prohibited from really expanding the dimensions further out, and at the time the wall was put up just to keep the ball in play, and keep fans outside. And as the hitters, in 1934, when the park was rebuilt by Tom Yawkey, they made it as enormous as it is today, because by that time, the baseball was livelier and hitters were stronger, and there was a threat of a lot of balls going over this and having a real easy home run. It's still considered an easy home run by a lot of hitters, but it gives and it takes, because line drives are often knocked down by them. They become singles, where they would be home runs in other ballparks. So It can work for or against a hitter, depending on what kind of a hitter he is.
And how a ball bounces off the Green Monster?
Well, that's another thing. I mean, they've changed the fabric of it over the years. There were tin panels for a long time that had a lot of dead spots in it where the ball might drop straight down if it hit the middle of a tin panel. And if it hits a seam where there's a beam behind it, it would, of course, bounce out much more truly and firmly and further. It's a little more uniform now. It's some sort of a fabricated material or something, but it's the bounces are truer. All the outfielders will tell you that. But there's still the angle of it, the closeness of it. It's very difficult for out-of-town outfielders to come in there and have any kind of mastery of it. And the Red Sox do have an advantage because their fielders know how to catch the carom a lot easier. It's like playing in your backyard. You have ground rules. You know, the tree is here. You know, the milk carton's here. And you know it better than the other guys know it. And so you know how to take advantage of those things.
Well, let's go back to 1912 when Fenway Park was built for $650,000. Give us a sense about what it was like to build this park and what the Boston elders had in mind.
Well, it went up very quickly. 1911 was they announced the plans for it, and they really built it in a year. And the Taylor family, which then owned the Boston Globe, built the ballpark. And they had been at the Huntington Grounds about less than a mile away for the first 10, 11 years of the franchise's existence. And the Taylor family had a realty company in the Fenway part of Boston and decided to build their new park there. And it was state-of-the-art, of course, when it went up. Tiger Stadium opened the same day, April 20th, 1912. One of the pieces of history that's unique about both buildings, and particularly Boston, is that the Titanic sank 5 days before Fenway opened. And when you go through microfilm in an attempt to dig out the stories about the first days of Fenway, they're really submerged, I guess you could say, by all the coverage of the Titanic, because news traveled very slowly, obviously, in those days. There was a tremendous amount of interest in the survivor lists, the lists of the dead, and so many of those people were from the Northeast because the boat was coming to New York. So that story just engulfs everything in the newspapers during those days. So the opening of Fenway was really not a big deal when it finally happened.
It's kind of amazing to imagine that there's still a functioning ballpark where the scoreboard is still hand-operated, but that's true at Fenway.
Yes, and that's going to come back. I mean, part of the charm of the new places is they're trying to make them like the old places. Right. And so you will see, I believe, in a lot of the new parks, hand-operated scoreboards, because it's got that Little Rascals feel to it, you know, the crooked numbers and sliding it into it. And in Boston, they've never gotten away from it. I think the new ones, it's kind of a charming, nostalgic aspect. St. Louis went back to it, which has been nice. They had a dreadful circular park built in the 60s, but they've tried to make it nice. They put real grass in it. They did go back to a hand-operated scoreboard. And, of course, Wrigley has to measure that. And I think some of the new ones will return to it.
But the idea of a slightly askew letter, that's very nostalgic for people?
Oh, sure. And, of course, in Boston, there's an Oz-like quality to it because you've got this little guy behind the wall. I mean, who knows who's there are humans in there. And one of the things we did in the book was, you know, Stan went inside the wall and took pictures from inside the wall of the action that this guy would see as he looks through the cracks where the slots are for the numbers. And it's in any other park, the guy who's inside the wall would be standing in left field. But in Boston, he's out in the street, basically. He's in home run territory because the wall is so close. But it's a very cramped, dark, hot in the summer, cold in the winter place. It's sort of a Quasimodo dwelling. And it's visited by all forms of rodents and other things, too. It's not a real great place.
Well, is being a scoreboard keeper a prized job at Fenway Park?
Well, over the years, it's been considered punishment by Joe Mooney, the grounds crew chief, to, you know, the guys who are late to work or aren't holding up their end. They get sentenced to wall duty.
Is that right?
Because the wall's a conductor of heat or cold, and it's whatever it is outside, it's twice as bad inside. So if it's April or October and it's cold, you got that. And if it's what it's been this summer, the guys, I talked to a guy who used to work in his underwear and his boots in there, you know, and just sweat it out through the game. It was just so hot. Yeah.
Well, I do want to talk some more, but first we're going to take a short break. And our guest today on the show is Dan Shaughnessy. He writes for the Boston Globe, and he's just written a book about Fenway Park in Boston, baseball park in Boston. It's called Fenway, and it has photographs by Stan Grossfeld. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is sports writer Dan Shaughnessy, and we're talking about his new book. It's a book about Fenway Park called Fenway, filled also with lots of photographs. I was interested, Ted Williams has a small essay in your book, and he says, I think the park has hurt the game some, but then he also goes on to say that it's really been home to me. And I get the feeling that for a lot of the players, there's a kind of love-hate feel that they have for Fenway Park.
Well, for a guy like Ted, I mean, he was there from 1939 to 1960. It was his home office, and he was a real baseball creature, a guy who didn't golf, he didn't have a lot of other interests. And so he was there early and stayed late. And some of that was to avoid crowds and those kind of things, but he just liked being around it. You know, it's where he'd read his mail and hang out and get his treatments for whatever aches or pains he had. It really was his home away from home, and maybe more than his home in many cases. So he has fond memories of all the years going to play there, but at the same time, he doesn't like the creation of an unfair game at some point and seeing a pitcher do really well and then have this ball that's not hit very far or very hard plop into the net for a game-winning three-run homer. And the unfairness of some of the long dimensions in right center field, which hurt his game and other pull hitters who batted left-handed. So he really has, you know, people were surprised with Ted doing the foreword for our book that he was not as nostalgic about it. Mm-hmm. Ted's a real contemporary guy. He's very generous to today's players. He's not one of these old curmudgeons who says the game was better in my day. He likes today's players. He likes today's game. And he thinks Boston needs a new park. And the last thing he wrote in his foreword, he said, I won't shed a tear. Take a lot of good pictures of it. And that's what Stan Grossfeld went out and did.
Do other teams not like playing at Fenway Park because it is, fairly rough and ready from some of the pictures in the book? It's clear that for high-priced ball players, there are no fancy locker rooms in this place.
Well, that's a good point. I mean, today's players basically, I think that when they're playing the game, they like the old-timey feel. They like the closeness of the fans. For a lot of hitters, like the dimensions, of course. And I think they like the fact that they're in a baseball town where the fans really do appreciate the opposition, if Ken Griffey Jr. or Cal Ripken Jr., if, you know, guys who are good players, worthy players, they get a lot of applause here. And if you make a great play, the fans understand that. So the players like that part of it. But today's players, as you point out, they like creature comforts, they like amenities, and there's not a lot of them here. So there's a lot of grousing about the small clubhouses, lack of training room facilities, players' lounges, batting cages, all the things, you know, sauna baths, you name it. I mean, Fenway is, this is, it's like being at a B&B instead of a five-star hotel, you know.
Oh, so, I don't even think it's a B&B. I'm looking at a picture of actually Red Sox catcher Scott.
The Scott Hatteberg picture.
Well, here he is. Well, maybe you can describe it for us.
Well, it's in the back of the book, and the Red Sox weren't particularly happy with that picture because Stan goes places where no one else goes. It's one of the charms of his photography. It's why he's won two Pulitzer Prizes. Mm-hmm. And he is, in this instance, he's captured Scott Hatteberg relieving himself in the trough, which is between the dugout and the clubhouse. And the interesting part about that is that trough is quite public. There's a small wall separating it from the dugout. And where Scott Hatteberg is relieving himself, if he were to lean back and look over his right shoulder, he could actually see the pitcher's mound. I mean, it's quite
no
public.
No privacy.
There's no privacy. And when you look at the runway around Hatteberg in this picture, it looks like Detective Andy Sipwood should be bursting into a three-decker somewhere. I mean, it's just this paint peeling off everywhere and the standing water, and it looks like a gross tenement building in New York City.
Why do you think Fenway Park has inspired so much writing, prose, poetry? Is it something about the park, or is it something about New Englanders?
We have the writers here, for one thing. I mean, I think it was John Cheever who said, all literary men are Red Sox fans, you know. And there is this Calvinistic sense of something bad's going to happen. And the fact that they built this place on a rock, you know, when we started this whole New England region on a rock. And it's hard times. And the Red Sox, they are hard times. You hope things are going to happen. Bad things happen, and then you complain about them all winter and start up again. So there's all this cycle of hope and dashed hopes. And then you've got, and it was easy rounding up, you know, people for this book. Stephen King's a season ticket holder. Doris Kearns has regular seats and has been bringing her sons there for years and years. And a lot of literary people live in the region, and they love baseball because it's the best game, especially the best game for writers. And, of course, Fenway itself is charming and easy to write about. And maybe it all started with John Updike when he went to Ted's last game in 1960 and wrote one of the greatest sports pieces of all time.
That helps.
That helps.
You described the fans, Red Sox fans, and I mean, it sounds like they appreciate good playing on both sides, but it sounds like you have to be long-suffering to be a Red Sox fan. You have to be willing to put up with those long drought periods.
Yeah, there's a great deal of narcissism about it. It's the woe-is-us attitude, and this is the only region that's been deprived. And, of course, folks in Chicago laugh at that because the Cubs go back to 1908 and the White Sox, it's been a long time. The Red Sox last won a World Series in 1918, and then they traded Babe Ruth 2 years later, and they've not won since. And that's where the curse of the Bambino comes in and all this folklore we have here about why bad things. The thing about the Sox is, over and above the Cubs or the White Sox or other teams that fail to win, is that they generally come close, so they make you think that they're going to do it. They've been in four World Series since 18 and lost each one in the seventh game. Mm. They've had 2 one-game playoffs for American League supremacy, lost them both at home. And there's been a lot of leads in the second half of the season where it was insurmountable, and all of a sudden they were blown, and they ended up not winning. So fans here tend to feel that something bad is going to happen if things are going well. And
it usually
you don't
does.
Have to be very old to remember Bill Buckner having that ground ball go through his legs, which was the ultimate Red Sox moment of the last 20 years.
Are you one to sort of tie yourself to one of the bleachers at Fenway Park and try to prevent the bulldozers from taking this place down, or do you think it's that Fenway has done its job and it's now time to build something better, different?
I was on the Save Fenway bandwagon for many, many years, and in a perfect world, I would like to see it last forever. I would like to keep going to games there. My children sit in the seats when I take them to the games, and we don't really complain about all the things that are wrong with it. And it's one of the interesting things is that Boston fans really don't complain about how much of it doesn't work because they just love being there so much. It's like going to the old church where you're your father was baptized 80 years ago, and you don't worry if it's cold or if a little bit leaky or there's no handicap rails or all the things that it should have. I mean, you forgive those things because it's where your dad was baptized. So I think that the fans here tend to take on that attitude. Sometimes when they go to other cities like Baltimore or Cleveland, they see these wonderful new parks that have old-timey feel to it. They do come back and say, you know, it could still be nice without being so wildly inconvenient. So I've come around to the realization that the Red Sox have no intention of staying in this park. And there are all kinds of vigilante groups here, Save Fenway. But it's private property. You really can't tell someone who has a lovely old house in your neighborhood that they must stay in it. If they want to bulldoze the house and rebuild, they get to do that if they have the means to do it. And that's really what we're looking at here, and it's nobody else's business. I know the Sox have no designs on staying where they are. They want to build a new park right behind the old park and recreate the dimensions and bring in a Camden Yards kind of feel, still in the city, right next to the old park, with the same dimensions. But you'll have wider aisles. You'll have space between your knees and the seat in front of you. You won't have troughs in the bathrooms. You'll be able to get concession food without waiting for two innings and missing things. There'll be better parking and access ramps, handicap rails, all the kind of things that Fenway is just unable to reproduce. You just can't make it bigger, and you can't scope out the bowl, and you won't be sitting behind poles anymore. I mean, they can still have this lovely park with kooky dimensions and not have so many people sitting behind poles trying to asking their neighbor what just happened. So, I mean, the Save Fenway people, I love them. My heart goes out to them, but they're basically like those Japanese warriors they found in the Philippines, you know, two or three years after World War II ended. You know, they didn't get the memo. You know, I mean, it's over.
It's done. I mean, they've made their decision.
They've made their decision. The good news for those of you who are worried about it is there's no great urgency about going to Fenway this weekend to see it before it's gone, because the way things work around Boston, it's a glacial pace to all this stuff. And, I mean, we could all be dead by the time they have the new park. So I'm looking at the bright side.
And I guess the date is what, early 2000?
They're saying 2003, and I'd add 5 years to that. Right. You know, that's a casual, generous estimation. I just don't think they can pull it off as fast. They're woefully ill-equipped and not prepared to do what they need to do. They've got to buy all kinds of land. There's tremendous intransigence in the neighborhood. There's people with flea bag hotels that all of a sudden announced they were going to build an MGM Grand on the site once the Red Sox wanted to buy their property. It's hilarious what's going on here, so... Again, don't feel the need to go rush to Fenway. Just buy our book and you'll preserve the memory. You'll be all set.
So how are the Red Sox doing this year?
Well, they're a threat. I mean, the American League has, you know, three dominant teams, you know, in Texas and New York, Yankees and Cleveland. And the Red Sox are fighting for that wild card position to make the playoffs with the other three.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Dan Shaughnessy, for joining us today on Fresh Air.
Thank you, Marty.
Dan Shaughnessy is a sports writer with the Boston Globe and is the author of Fenway, a biography in words and pictures, which features photographs by Stan Grossfeld. He spoke with Marty Moscowane. This is Fresh Air.